Just this past week, Cincinnati had high-profile visits from U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno and Ohio gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, both here to talk about violent crime that's been dominating the headlines. But what does the data tell us about public safety in the city, and how much do the numbers matter? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss what's happening to reduce violent crime and talk about how to understand the data. We'll also hear about a family's settlement with the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority and explore some Ohio history that continues to resonate today. Joining me now to get us started are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and general assignment reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Becca and Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Nick, Senator Bernie Moreno, as I mentioned, was in town this week to talk about public safety. Explain why he was here and who he met with.
Yeah, Senator Moreno was here to meet with city officials, so that'd be the mayor, police chief, as well as some federal law enforcement officials who are headquartered here in Cincinnati, and representatives from the county sheriff's office. Specifically, was here to talk about the incident that happened July 26th, the large fight brawl downtown, and crime more generally as well.
And he had floated this idea of withholding federal funding after a video of that fight downtown went viral. What was he saying after the meeting this week?
Yeah, so he mentioned that in a press conference after the meeting with city officials. And he didn't walk it back necessarily, but he had softened his tone. He's like, look, I don't want to do that. It's a blunt instrument. I don't have a lot of tools at my disposal as senator for, dealing with cities. And then he kind of later in his talk said, I'm not trying to single Cincinnati out. This could have happened in Cleveland or Akron, other cities. So he seemed to kind of be softening his tone a little bit on that.
Did he offer any ideas about how to reduce crime?
He talked a lot about mandatory minimum sentencing, which I think we've been hearing a lot about very recently. He talked about increasing the number of police officers in Cincinnati and other cities. And then also there were some more kind of nebulous proposals about how to treat people who might witness a crime and not try to help, people who maybe filmed a brawl or something like that.
Such a bystanders who didn't call 911.
Yeah.
Okay, so Nick, a woman who was injured in the fight was with Senator Moreno. What did she have to say?
Yeah, so the woman's name, she only gave her first name out of, I think, concern for her safety, given the kind of broad reach this incident has had. She said her name was Holly, and she talked about the injuries she sustained, which she's still recovering from. She said they might be permanent. A lot of bruising to her face still, you could see, and some maybe injuries we can't see, but that are there. She expressed, I think the main point she made was she was very disappointed that most people filmed the incident instead of calling police or trying to get help for her in some way. She also talked about things like bail. There needs to be kind of stricter bail, stricter sentencing, echoing Moreno's points a little bit.
Yeah. You mentioned, I think, that the mayor was there. Excuse me. What did he have to say about this meeting?
The mayor was not at the meeting.
Yeah,
he was at the meeting with Moreno. He was not at the press conference after. So he was after Moreno's press conference, the mayor issued a statement saying, the meeting that he had was productive. They talked about, some things that they have commonality on. But it was pretty basic, neutral statement. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify for listeners, they met privately without media beforehand. And then there was this news conference where the mayor was not.
Okay. Good information. Well, Becca, in that statement, I think I saw that the mayor also talked about how the city's been acting quickly and proactively. Just this week, Cincinnati City Council approved new curfews in the city. Tell us about the curfews.
Yeah, so there's, technically speaking, two actions that City Council took. One was to amend the existing curfew for minors that's been on the books since the 90s, so it's been there a long time. That curfew for a long time has said that if you are under the age of 16, the curfew was 10 p.m. If you were 16 or 17 years old, the curfew was midnight. So officials said it was difficult to enforce because it was a little bit confusing on the different different times and also for many other reasons. So the amendment to the citywide curfew just makes it a uniform time. It's 11 p.m. So if you are under the age of 18, you cannot be in public unsupervised by an adult that is at least 21 years old after 11 p.m. That will go into effect. It is already in effect. It went into effect immediately. The other action that council took was to establish what they're calling a special extended curfew district. So this is an area specifically in downtown and parts of Over the Rhine, southern Over the Rhine, closer to downtown. And that is where the curfew will start at 9 p.m. And officials say, you know, the rationale there is most of the issue they've had with like large groups of teenagers that might cause problems. For the most part, that's happening downtown and in Over the Rhine and not in other parts of the city. There are all kinds of exceptions. Obviously, if a minor is accompanied by an adult who is a parent or guardian or someone who can kind of take responsibility for them, they can still be out. So if you go to a Reds game with your teenager and, you know, you don't have to worry about being home by 9 p.m. And also lots of exceptions for things like, you know, if the young person has a job and they are on their way home from that job at midnight and they happen to be downtown, as long as they're going straight home, that's no problem. So lots of exceptions there. The goal is not to say that young people can't exist in downtown, you know, after that time, but rather to put some restrictions on it so that this problem type of large groups of young people potentially causing problems and potentially committing crimes can be kind of corralled.
So that's the reason for the change, to try to manage these potentially large groups of young people who might get unruly from time to time.
That is, you know, they've talked about some specific instances of like groups of teenagers. You know, this goes back to the restriction of Red Bike after 8 p.m. On weekend nights. The idea that, you know, they have found groups of young people who are breaking into cars, stealing cars, you know, committing these kind of property offenses, and that a curfew is one way to, you know, hopefully get behind that and prevent some of that from happening, but also give police kind of an enforcement tool to say, you know, well, I can't prove you were committing a crime, but, you know, it's not a good idea for you to be here right now.
Hmm. The Cincinnati Park Board is changing the hours of some parks to explain what those changes are, the reasons behind them, if there are exceptions there.
Yeah, so this is action that the Board of Park Commissioners took pretty much right after the City Council action. It's meant to be complementary to the curfew. So park hours in general are not changing, but for seven specific parks that are located in downtown and over the Rhine, the parks close at 9 p.m. for minors under 18. All of the same rules apply. If in addition, if they are there for like, for example, the city does sponsored like open skate nights down at Smale. And, you know, there are free skate rentals there. If a teenager is participating in a city-sponsored event, and even if their own parent or guardian is not there, they are welcome to stay there past 9 p.m. That's a sanctioned event. That's fine. But it's basically saying that these specific parks are closed at 9 p.m. for minors that are under 18. Now, looking at the list, all but one of them are within that extended curfew district anyway. So it really is no change. I think it's more just formalizing the rules for the parks so they match the rules for the curfew district. The only one that's not within that curfew district is the International Friendship Park along the river. That's kind of just outside the district. But everything else, those include like Ziegler Park, Washington Park, Yatman's Cove, Sawyer Point, the Public Landing. Those are all parks that are already within the curfew district that council established.
So under this new curfew policy, what happens if a teenager violates curfew? Could somebody who does that be charged with a crime? Could their parents be charged?
Yeah, so the process that the police chief and the city manager have laid out is that what they're looking for is compliance. So if a police officer encounters a young person who is, you know, not supervised and is not supposed to be downtown, they'll say, hey, you need to go home. If the young person goes home, that's the end. There's no record. There's no exchange of information even. If that young person refuses to go home, then they could be detained by that officer, in which case the officer will try to contact a parent or guardian, someone that can come pick up the person. If the young person discloses where they live, the officer can take them home. And then it kind of escalates to, you know, there's a little flow chart that's actually really useful. It's available on our website. You know, if that information doesn't happen, The city has established on Friday and Saturday evenings a curfew center. So they're going to be working with Seven Hills Neighborhood Houses. There's a what's called the Neighborhood House in the West End. It will be open on Friday and Saturday evenings so that officers who can't contact a parent or guardian of a curfew violator can take them there. And then the officer can go about their shift. And there, like, these kind of community advocates and partners will take over. They will also try to contact a parent or guardian. There's state law that says, you know, they can the city can only kind of keep custody of a young person for a certain period of time. So that's the sort of time period they're working with there. If they still cannot find a parent or guardian or information on where to take this young person who's violating curfew, they could be taken to Lighthouse Youth and Family Services, to Meekum House. And that's an opportunity for a young person who maybe doesn't have somewhere to go or doesn't have a place to sleep. They can go there and they can stay overnight at no charge. The caveat to that, though, is that the Meekum House services, it's voluntary. So if a young person is taken there, they can walk out immediately. And it's a little bit unclear what happens if we get to that scenario. But the concept and what officials have been saying is that that's kind of a last-ditch effort anyway, that there will be multiple steps where a young person will have the opportunity to go home on their own or to be taken home by an officer and never even go to the curfew center.
Just briefly, did any council members raise concerns about this? I'm wondering, were there concerns that, you know, kids could feel like, hey, I'm being treated like a criminal just because I'm out late, or concerns that the police are awfully busy? Like, do they have time to be stopping kids and trying to figure out how old they are?
Yeah, all of that concerns expressed by various council members. Now, it did pass with unanimous support. So council members who expressed concern, you know, said, these are the things I'm worried about and I want us to pay attention to it. But it didn't prevent them from supporting the effort. So in addition to the things that you mentioned, you know, there are certainly concerns about criminalizing youth, and the city officials are trying to include the message that this is about safety. It's about keeping young people safe so that they don't become victims of crime if they're out unsupervised, and also trying to keep kids out of the criminal justice system, that if they can prevent a young person from engaging in property crime or something like that with a group of their friends, that's a version of protection as well. One of the other things that Councilmember Evan Nolan mentioned is he said he was kind of concerned about this idea that we might be discouraging like schools, for example, or organizations from hosting events downtown because they fear that the curfew might be a problem. So, for example, he said that for his like senior prom, it was supposed to be downtown and it was moved to Butler County because of curfew concerns. Now, because a sanctioned event with chaperones is an exception, you know, that's technically not, wouldn't necessarily come up. But Councilmember Nolan pointed out that, you know, if a school is worried that like, oh, we have our prom, you know, somewhere, and then afterwards teens like leave but stick around and are taking pictures in Washington Park or something, for example, that a school or an organization might just opt out of that altogether because they're worried about enforcement after a sanctioned event.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, I did not answer part of your question earlier, so I do want to answer that quickly. So a young person who is violating curfew, it's called a status offense. So they could be found guilty of a curfew violation, but that's not a criminal record. And a parent or guardian or adult who should be supervising that minor could be charged with a minor misdemeanor. So those are the possibilities. And also, you know, a young person cannot be incarcerated simply for a curfew violation. Now, if an officer encounters someone who's violating curfew and they also caught them breaking into a car and they are charged with that crime, then they'll be taken to the Juvenile Justice Center, or the Hamilton County Juvenile Justice Center, and charged with that crime, and then may also be charged with a curfew violation. But a young person whose only real offense is being outside unsupervised after curfew hours will not be charged with a crime or incarcerated for that.
Okay. Thank you for adding that. Nick, before Senator Moreno came to town, Vivek Ramaswamy was here. He was also talking about public safety. He's, of course, running for governor in Ohio. He was a former Republican presidential candidate. How big was this town hall that he had?
Yeah, so Ramaswamy spoke at Jim and Jack's, which is a bar and restaurant and venue, kind of performance venue, in the Riverside neighborhood right by the Ohio River. This is a, you know, not a large venue, it was pretty much filled to capacity. So, you know, we're not supposed to estimate crowds, but they did pack this sort of like smaller venue.
Mm-hmm. Did he have a lot of people there with him?
He did. He had a lot of local Republican figures, either people who are former elected officials or want to become elected officials, including former Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, who kind of co-hosted the event. He talked a lot and kind of like took a lot of questions. There was mayoral candidate Cory Bowman. And then there was Sarah Herringer, whose husband, Pat, was murdered in Over the Rhine earlier this summer. And there were some other sort of Republican figures there as well.
What did you hear from people who attended this town hall, the people who were in the audience?
There were a lot of questions about public safety. There were a lot of folks who spoke about being touched by violence in one way or another, either knowing someone who had was a victim of violence, or in some cases, this happened several times where people talked about family members who had done something violent and you know, kind of their experience with the legal system and how they thought maybe they got off easier than they should have.
Mm. Did Vivek Ramaswamy have ideas that he offered up for reducing crime?
Much like Senator Moreno, I think Republicans are kind of coalescing around some key points here. He talked about bail. He talked about sentencing, harsher sentences. He talked about needing more police. And then he talked a lot about sort of the culture of respecting police. And you know, I think that Republicans feel the police are not respected enough. In general.
Yeah. And it sounds like there were some protesters at this event.
There were. There were people on the other side of the street who had signs kind of pointing out different things I don't like about Ramaswamy or the Republican Party. The people who were there that I talked to, some of them were very concerned about the specific rhetoric around the fight that happened July 26th and feeling that it had been racialized or politicized for, you know, the gain of people like Ramaswamy. Others were a little bit more kind of like thinking about Ramaswamy's campaign for governor and saying, no, I got somebody else that I want to vote for. A lot of folks, fans of Amy Acton were there protesting. Mm-hmm. And then other folks were there just because they felt like, hey, you know, our city's getting a bad rap right now and we would like to voice a different opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, Becca, we've been talking a lot about reactions to crime, either actions the city has taken, the reactions of these high-profile people who came into town to talk about it. You spent time digging into how these crime statistics are reported. Why do you think people seem so skeptical about the data that gets released?
I do think in this particular moment this summer in Cincinnati, that can be at least partly attributed to what Nick was just talking about, which is the politicization of these kind of high-profile incidents, these things that have gotten a lot of media attention. Now, one thing that is the case, I think the result of that, is that folks who maybe are not following the news generally are seeing these stories because it's coming across their feed on social media in particular. And so there's more awareness of crime because these incidents have gotten so much attention. So I think that's a big part of it. But it is also the case that crime data and crime statistics are complicated. They can be difficult to understand. They can be easy to manipulate if someone wanted to manipulate those. And so I think confusion in general is understandable. You know, there can be kind of contradictory, what seem like contradictory statements that are both true just because we're using different definitions of type of crime or which part of the city or what time period we're referencing. And so I think in general, you know, people can be confused by that. And especially if they're hearing numbers from different news outlets and then also from public officials and then also people running for public office, you know, there's a lot of numbers swirling around and it can be hard to understand what if we're all even talking about the same thing.
Can you explain briefly how the police report this data? Because you mentioned, you know, there are different time periods. There are different ways to categorize the data. There are different parts of town that they can report on. Can you explain just briefly how that all works? And I will tell people there's a very in-depth explanation of that on our website, wvxu.org, that they should check out. But tell us briefly about that.
Yeah. So in generally speaking, so I spoke with Jillian Desmond, who leads the Cincinnati Police Department's Crime Analysis Unit. There are, in addition to Jillian Desmond, there are six crime analysts. So their full-time job is to look at the numbers of what's happening in Cincinnati and try to narrow that down as much as possible to solve a problem that police can prevent that crime. So there is certainly a lot of effort in the Cincinnati Police Department to look at those numbers. There are weekly reports that the public can access. One report shows numbers for the whole city and then has a breakdown for each police district. And then there are also reports for each of Cincinnati's 52 neighborhoods. Those are technically different reports, but they're both publicly accessible. I think a lot of thought seems to go into, you know, what should these reports include? It would be unreasonable to see a weekly report of every type of crime that a person could be charged with and numbers on that. What the citywide report focuses on is what we call part one crime. It's the more serious crime. That includes a separate, like, kind of category for violent crime and then a separate category for property crime. And then, as you mentioned, like, there's sort of this regional look as well of, like, each district and then each neighborhood. Even within a neighborhood, most of the violent crime in particular tends to happen in a very small segment of the city. We are talking a lot about downtown and over the Rhine. That's where a lot of the kind of violent crime that we've been talking about tends to happen. So even saying something as simple as, you know, you could kind of narrow it down further. Like, violent crime in Cincinnati is hypothetical, is down X percent. And then say, okay, well, I live in East Price Hill. So what does that do for me? I don't know where the crime is happening. So I can narrow that down to District 3, which is where I live. I can narrow that down to East Price Hill. I can also look at a map of over the last 28 days where actual offenses in East Price Hill have occurred. All of those are questions that tend to be too detailed to fit into a headline or even a news story, but it's something that any person can access on their own and look at and ask questions like, if I see a headline that says there are more homicides in the city, I should be empowered to know where I can look at that number for myself and look at where those are happening and when those have all happened. Those are links and information that folks can find on our website to find that. Those are kind of some of the basic questions. One of the other questions I think is significant is when you talk about percentage increases, because a percentage increase can be helpful if we're talking about a big number, like theft from auto or auto theft. Those are some of the most common part one crimes that we see in Cincinnati. So if there's a big percentage change there, that's a more understandable way to look at that number sometimes. But when we're talking about violent crimes, sometimes in particular, like homicide or like, a robbery or aggravated assault, the percentage change might seem huge, but we might be talking about one additional incident or five additional incidents over a period of 6 months. And so a percentage change can be kind of misleading, and it can give you either a false sense of, you know, how big an increase is or even how big a decrease is. I feel like I have not answered this question very well. I think those are examples of some of the questions. Those are some of the reasons that crime data can be confusing and some of the questions that people can ask themselves when they see a news story about crime and really look for themselves about, you know, does this tell the story? Does it answer the question that I'm interested in about how safe I feel in my neighborhood or a neighborhood I'm visiting? It could go on forever. There are lots of other, like, more detailed reasons, but I think those are kind of the big ones.
Yeah. Well, and we got a question yesterday on the show. We were talking about violent crime. We got a call from Jennifer who said, you know, do we know why these high profile crimes have increased over the past year? We didn't have time to answer it yesterday, but I thought Becca's going to be on the show tomorrow. After digging into the data, what are your thoughts about that kind of question?
Yeah, I think it depends what we mean by high-profile crime, right? So I think there are some obvious things that make a crime in Cincinnati high-profile. Maybe it involves a public official or a famous person that, you know, has name recognition. And so a person whose car was, you know, Joe Burrow is a great example, whose home was broken into. You know, the news isn't going to do a story on every break-in, every burglary, but they are going to do a story about Joe Burrow's home being burglarized. So I think the question is, on one hand, are there more crimes of this type happening in Cincinnati? The other question could be, are we just hearing about these types of crimes more often? I think the answer is more the latter. I think it is more likely that crimes like the brawl that went viral, the video of that brawl, that it was more likely to get news coverage for some factors, the fact that it's an election year and that, you know, we saw the way this story went national was really pushed by some folks who are running for office and used that as a way to say things are out of control and I will control it better. So that's a factor. I don't think that the data supports the idea that high-profile crimes are happening more often. There are some crimes that are happening more often and some that are happening less often. And that kind of goes back to how complicated that data can be. But I think a more basic way to look at that, too, is just social media. I mean, you know, that's more of a long-term trend than, like, over the last couple of years. But the fact that that fight in particular, so many people were recording it and posted it online, that would not have been true 15 years ago.
Yeah.
It makes something like that more likely to be publicized and available to the public just because of how our, like, internet landscape has changed.
Well, there is so much more to get into with this. I really recommend, if you haven't read Becca's story on our website, go there to get a lot more in-depth information, wvxu.org. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
And Nick Swartzel is going to stay with us. Up next, a multi-million-dollar wrongful death settlement and the change it could bring. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A local family has announced a settlement with the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority in a lawsuit over the death of Beverly Kinney. WVXU General Assignment Reporter Nick Swartzel has stayed with us to talk about that. Thanks for sticking around, Nick.
Always a pleasure, Lucy.
And Cincinnati Enquirer Enterprise Reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry is here with us, too. Welcome back, Patty.
Happy to be here.
Patty, Beverly Kinney was a longtime volunteer and supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. We have a room named for her in this building, a street named for her nearby. Tell us how she died.
Beverly was coming home from a walk on January 11, 2024, actually from this very building. She had walked up here to just take a look at the construction that was underway. She was heading back to her condo in Hyde Park on Dana, about to cross at what street is that? Sorry, Duck Creek. She stepped off the curb. She got 8 to 10 feet into the street, and she was hit by a Metro bus that was making a right-hand turn onto Duck Creek.
Oh. And her family sued Metro and the man who was driving the bus that hit her. What did the family allege in that lawsuit, Patty?
Well, essentially recklessness, that Metro and its owner were reckless in hiring and keeping driver Dion Willis because he had a poor driving record, and that the driver himself was reckless in not seeing, saying that was his point of view, that he did not see Beverly Kinney, that he was reckless in his driving that day.
Hmm. Nick, her family announced a settlement in that lawsuit a little earlier this week. What were the financial terms of that settlement?
Yeah, so under the settlement, Metro will pay $10 million to the family, but the family's not going to just keep that money. The Greater Cincinnati Foundation is kind of administering a fund that will go to causes that Beverly supported.
Yeah, did they say any more about their plans for that money, those causes? Or
They didn't give specific examples, but they did kind of say, hey, these are organizations that Beverly supported in the past. La Soupe, Cincinnati Public Radio was mentioned, and those are the kinds of organizations that this fund will be supporting in the future. So I think from what I heard from the family, they're still sorting that out and making plans, but it sounds like there'll be things that Beverly supported.
Yeah. She was a very active volunteer in a number of organizations. Patty, the settlement also includes safety reforms for Metro, as I understand it. Explain what those are.
Right. So it was very important to the Kinney family that Metro look at its training of drivers. And so they are seeking a more beefed up training program. They're going to require that drivers go through 3 annual video reminders about driving, about turning procedures. They're going to actually have the video of the turn that killed their wife and their mother in that. They're going to have testimonials from the Kinney family about losing Beverly Kinney. The settlement included the non-financial aspects of the settlement, included beefed up training and other kinds of safety enhancements.
You've reported in depth, Patty, on how Metro hires its drivers, and we've talked about that in the past on this show. Remind us just briefly what you found there.
Right. So I did a lot of reporting last year on driver records. So not so much on the hiring, but the performance of drivers after they're hired. Our reporting found that in the prior decade, there had been 275 people injured by Metro buses, showed their own statistics, which they did provide to us, showed high turnover of drivers, high number of missed trips, a high number of drivers who show up early or late, you know, causing people to miss their ride. Absenteeism was a problem. Preventable accidents were a problem. And settlements, as we're talking about today, also is something that is a result of some of these incidents.
Yeah. What will this settlement require any changes to how Metro does hiring?
No, actually, hiring is not addressed in the settlement. Really, it's just on the training front, more stringent in that regard, and also holding Metro accountable by having an audit of its training policies and procedures.
Mm. Nick, what happened to the bus driver who was driving the bus that hit and killed Beverly Kinney?
So Dan Willis eventually pleaded guilty to vehicular homicide. That's a misdemeanor. He was given 1,000 hours of community service, and his driving privileges were limited. I know eventually he was allowed to drive to that community service, but I think otherwise he was not able to drive.
Mm. Patty, have you talked to him?
I did talk to him briefly at the courthouse when he was sentenced, and I did call him last week before we reported on the settlement. He did not have a comment either time, but I do know that he met with the Kinney family after one court proceeding, that he did apologize to the family, and as I indicated earlier, he has said in court documents that he did not see her. He just did not see her.
Hmm. Patty, what would a trial have been like for the family? I mean, this is such a horrible loss they experienced.
Pretty traumatic from what they have said. They wanted to avoid that. That's part of the motivation behind the settlement. They didn't want a protracted procedure. They also believe they may not have gotten the agreements and the concessions out of Metro vis-a-vis the training. And also, John Kinney told me that the family has not viewed the video of their mother's death and didn't want to, and thought for sure if there was a jury trial that that would be shown in court and they'd have a hard decision about whether to watch that.
And John Kinney, that's one of her sons?
One of her sons, correct.
Mm. Nick, what did Metro have to say about this settlement?
Metro offered sympathy to the Kinney family and basically said, look, we care about safety as well. This is an agreement that both honors Beverly's memory and reflects that we really are trying to be as safe as we can be.
Hmm. Patty, how does this settlement compare to other cases Metro has settled in the past? You mentioned you've reported on those, and how much of the settlement does Metro itself have to pay?
So our reporting last year showed that Metro had paid out $18 million in settlements over the prior decade. This is now adding $10 million to that total. It matches what was, at least last year when I got the data, the high point of settlements in 2016 or following a 2016 accident. Metro paid $10 million to the estate of a man named Stephen Frank, who was hit and killed by a Metro bus in Hyde Park in 2016. It paid out, the second highest award went to a young man named DiCarlo Fowler. He was hit and injured, severely injured by a Metro bus in 2018, and Metro settled that case for $6 million.
And these settlement dollars, is that money that comes directly from Metro, the entire amount?
What they told me in the case of Beverly Kinney, they absorb close to around $1 million of that, and its insurer picks up the rest, covers the rest.
Well, thank you both for keeping us up to date on what's happening with Beverly Kinney's family and this settlement. I've been talking with Cincinnati Edition Enterprise reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry and WVXU General Assignment reporter Nick Sportzell. Thank you both for your time today.
Sure.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, we'll discuss some Ohio history and how it continues to resonate today. This is Cincinnati Edition.
You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. This week marks 80 years since the United States dropped atomic bombs on Japan. Joining me now to talk about why an Ohio university is commemorating the bombing and another piece of Ohio history that continues to resonate today are the Ohio Newsroom reporters Kendall Crawford and Aaron Gottsacker. Welcome back, Kendall and Aaron.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, Kendall, let's start with you. Tell us about the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College and how it's connected to these atomic bombings.
Yeah, so the center was established 50 years ago by Quaker activist Barbara Reynolds. And it's really unique in the country because it's devoted to capturing the human experience of nuclear war. So there are lots of archives in the U.S. that document the USS bombing of Japan. But they're more focused on it from the U.S. perspective. Think like Oppenheimer's perspective about our participation in that. This kind of archive really focuses on the aftermath, like what happened after in the years, the decades after. So that's how this center is unique, and all of the different archival materials that they have focus on that perspective.
So what kind of materials does the Peace Resource Center have? Where did those materials come from?
Yeah, so it has a lot of testimonies from Hibakusha or atomic bomb sufferers, so those firsthand accounts. But it also has historic photos and posters, cassette tapes, and they were all collected by Barbara Reynolds. So she was an Ohioan and a Quaker, and she was married to Earl Reynolds, who was a physical anthropologist. He was asked by the U.S. government after the war, or after the bombing, to go to Japan and study the children there who survived, about how that impacted the children there. And in doing that work, both of them became really involved in the nuclear disarmament movement. They became advocates against this kind of military violence. And so they started doing those collections, those interviews. And really, all that's in the archive is a result of Barbara Reynolds' work.
Why Wilmington College?
So like I mentioned, Reynolds, she was a Quaker, and Wilmington College is a Quaker college. So it has a long background of, presidents who were conscientious objectors. It has been committed to nonviolence. And so she was from Ohio. When she returned, she found like a natural partner with them, and they agreed to kind of save her work and advocate for it in the future.
How does the center use these archives?
Yeah, so a lot of it is about, you know, that call for nuclear disarmament and making sure people remember that this happened. And then they just have a lot of events that center around nonviolence more generally. So they've invited in different Quaker artists to talk about their art. And each year they put on this peace symposium where they invite people from across the world to talk about committing to nonviolence and disarmament. And so really all that she collected has been used kind of for advocacy and art.
Do they have special things going on this year with it being the 80th anniversary?
Yes. They ramped up their offerings for programming quite a lot this year. So there's actually two plays. There's an art exhibit that's going on. It's already open right now that has not only some of the archival objects from Barbara Reynolds' collection, it also has different pieces from contemporary artists that comment on atomic bombing. And they're also going to have an academic conference. So they're really just having a lot this fall.
What do they hope will come out of all of these events? This happened such a long time ago. What are they hoping for today in the present?
Yeah, I think from talking with the director of the center, Tanya Moss, it's hoping that this archive and the artists that are continuing kind of this advocacy for disarmament, they're hoping they can be kind of the cornerstone, just kind of say, hey, there are people here that are against, you know, military violence and conflict. And they want it to be just kind of a physical manifestation of that kind of movement.
You mentioned the executive director. Does she feel like this work is just as relevant today as it was when the center started?
Yes, definitely. That was something that she said was kind of difficult to ignore right now. I know if you listen to NPR in the morning, you're likely to hear about global conflicts and that debate around nuclear weapons and who should have them is something that is very much still widely debated today. And so because of those reasons, she thinks that looking at these experiences, even though they were 80 years ago, is really vital to the present moment.
Erin, let's shift to some Ohio history. Tell us about the Treaty of Greenville. I have to confess that your story introduced me to the Treaty of Greenville and what it meant for the state of Ohio.
Okay, yeah. Well, Lucy, you're not alone. I learned all about this treaty when I reported on it, too. But the Treaty of Greenville, this was signed 230 years ago this month. And it was an agreement between the young United States of America and the Northwestern Confederacy. That was an alliance of indigenous nations like the Shawnee and the Miami, the Wyandotte, and the Potawatomi. And the U.S., of course, wanted to expand westward into the homelands of these indigenous nations, and that was prompting just a lot of conflict and violence. So in 1795, these two groups came together to hash out a peace deal. And the agreement they came up with, that's what we call the Treaty of Greenville. Basically, it split what we now know as the state of Ohio in two, from the mouth of the Cuyahoga River in the northeast to Fort Recovery on the Indiana border in the west. Everything south of that line was reserved for new American settlers. Everything north of it was left for those indigenous nations. And at the time, this was just a really momentous agreement. It took a lot of work. There were a lot of translators there because, of course, all of these different indigenous nations spoke different languages. It took months to work out. And the vision was that the Treaty of Greenville would let indigenous people and American settlers live side by side in peace through, you know, perpetuity.
Huh. Well, you visited the Greenville Treaty line in North Central Ohio. Why are county engineers resurveying that line?
Well, this is a really historically important line, and it's shaped the geography of Ohio. County and township lines run along this line. Roads have been built along it. Even like private fences that separate individual property lines like are really closely stick to this line. But it's been a long time since it was surveyed and mapped out. The Greenville Treaty line was originally surveyed in 1797. So
wow.
That was just after the treaty was signed. And the surveyor that marked it with wooden stakes and blazed trees. So flash forward to just a couple years ago, in honor of the 225th anniversary of that original survey, the county engineer in Holmes County launched a project to retrace the history. And so he researched and surveyed and marked 30 miles of the Greenville Treaty line that ran through his county, and then counties to the west of him kind of picked up that project. And so a couple more counties have participated, and they're hoping they can continue the project until it reaches the Indiana border.
How are they marking the line now? I'm guessing not wooden stakes and trees.
not wooden stakes and trees. They have, each county is a little different, but they have these small discs, like the size of a small dinner plate or a pancake. And the discs, they obviously say Greenville Treaty Line, and they have a little dashed line that runs through it. And so you have to use your imagination a little bit, but you can just imagine that line going out on either side, and that's where it ran. And so they're nothing too showy. They're not really meant to celebrate this history. It's more to acknowledge it and remember it. And these engineers say this line is still used in property surveys today, so they want to make sure it's accurate.
Well, you mentioned that the whole idea behind this treaty was so that these indigenous nations and these new settlers could live in peace. But that didn't last very long. Tell us what happened there and just a little bit more about the lasting impact that this Treaty of Greenville has had.
Yeah, unfortunately, peace did not prevail in the long term, and the U.S. government just continued pushing indigenous nations further and further west. I think, you know, we are hopefully familiar with stories that are really horrific, like the Trail of Tears. But the Treaty of Greenville did have lasting effects. Like I said, it shaped the geography of Ohio, but it also marked the beginning of this government-to-government relationship between the United States and indigenous nations like the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. This was the first of many treaties that tribe signed with the United States. And those are relationships and treaties that still exist today.
Yeah. So for the people you talked with, Erin, why is it so important to remember this history all these years later? You talked about kind of from the surveyor's perspective, but you also talk to people who are members of some of these tribes, right?
Yeah, I spoke with George Ironstrack, and he's a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. He also works with the Miamia Center at Miami University. And he said, you know, the Miami tribe didn't want to cede all of its homelands to the United States, but it recognized that this was the price they would have to pay for peace. This is the price that they were going to have to pay. And so that's what they did, with hopes that that peace would last. And unfortunately, it didn't. They signed numerous more treaties over the years. But I thought George said something that really stuck with me. And he said that in the tribe's view, those treaties are how the United States came into existence. It's the reason that we have the United States. It's how the U.S. legally acquired this land. And so in a way, we're all treaty people. And so that's why it's important to remember, you know, like we said at the beginning of this conversation, a lot of us aren't familiar with this history, or may have forgotten about it, or don't know really the details of it. But it's really important to the story of the founding of our country, and certainly to the history of Ohio.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about two stories about history that both of you have done, but you do so much more terrific work. You know, I'm a super fan of your work, both of you as reporters. Kendall, I'm going to throw you this curveball. What's your, can you pick favorites? This is like children, you're not supposed to pick favorites, but what are some of the stories that you've worked on lately that you've reported for the Ohio Newsroom that really stand out to you that maybe we could direct our listeners to look for on our website, wbxu.org?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about Greenville. So I recently went there for a story. I went to Dark County's Annie Oakley Festival. And it was so much fun. I got to watch a sharpshooting competition for the first time in my life.
Did you enter?
No. Okay. I was hoping maybe somebody would look over at me and be like, she looks like Annie Oakley. Yeah. Give me the BB gun.
Yeah.
But the competition was for young women in Dark County between 12 and 19 years old. They all dressed up in like cowgirl boots, and they had the fringe, and they all lined up and shot at a red balloon with a BB gun. And I was just amazed. They went back, the winners went back 110 feet away from the balloon. So she got crowned Miss Annie Oakley. And that's, of course, because Annie Oakley is from Ohio. And so I did not know that, despite, you know, a neighborhood being called Oakley here. I don't know for sure if that's related, yeah. Yeah, I thought that was such an interesting piece of history, and then it's cool to see it like lived out, and these young women, they were just so cool and so excited to be there, and so yeah, that was a really fun one.
Yeah, people still embracing it. What about you, Erin? I'm going to ask you to pick a favorite baby just for the purposes of this discussion, not for forever.
Well, I recently went to Youngstown to visit a swimming pool there in the Youngstown Lifeguard Academy. And it was so cool because, you know, I think a lot of places in Ohio and really across the country are facing a lifeguard shortage. There's just not enough people to do this job. But in Youngstown, there's this man who recognized that there was a shortage, but there was also a need for young people, especially in the city, might not have as many resources as others of us, to have a summer job and to make some money, which could allow them to go to college or pursue future jobs. And yeah. So it was just a neat initiative they have going on there.
Well, I love those two stories. You can check out all of their work on WVXU.org. I've been talking with the Ohio Newsroom reporters, Erin Gottsacker and Kendall Crawford. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.